This is the Culinary Historians of New York.
Really needs very little introduction, but I can't help myself because she is the founder of the French cooking school La Varenne, which is at Château du Fay in Paris. She has received James Beard Foundation Awards for her best international cookbooks, photography of the in the cookbooks, Lifetime Achievement Awards from Les Dames d'Escoffier, and the Culinary Teacher of the Year from the International Association of Culinary Professionals. She started her career as an associate editor of the much lamented Gourmet magazine and food editor of the Washington Star. But really, she is known as a cooking teacher and culinary historian with an amazing collection of historical cookery books. They are just glorious. And she is going to share some of them with us through Women in the Kitchen. And I'd like to start with just a general question for Anne. Why these 12 women? What was it about these women that so captivated your imagination and their role in creating the way we cook today?
Well, I think I can safely say that each of them, and there are 12, broke new ground in the field. And of course, the very first was Hannah Woolley, 1671. And that was the first cookbook written by a woman to be printed in English. There may have been one in German, but I don't read German. And she set the stage for a famous name, Hannah Glass. And both Hannah Woolley and Hannah Glass were in circulation in early America. And the next one, which is fascinating, is Amelia Simmons, the first American cookbook, 1796. We've got a picture. There is Hannah Woolley. You can see Hannah was not just writing recipes. She was very concerned with women's appearance. That's the title page. Goodness knows if she really looked like that, or it was just wishful thinking, but it's really rather charming. And then the next spread is Hannah Glass. Now, Hannah Glass is an astonishing cookbook. For one thing, this is just a very small part of the index. It has 1,000 recipes and is a beautiful, beautiful book in the first edition. It's, I have a facsimile over on the shelf there, and it's probably something like 12 by 18 inches square. Lovely open pages of type. And her recipes work, though there are some quite funny ones that take you strange places, specialties for sea voyages, which is probably because she had a brother who was a lieutenant in the Royal Navy. And she's sort of one of my favorites. She came from Northumberland, and I was born up in Yorkshire, also in the north of England. Anyway, there were all sorts of things to say about Hannah Glass. She was well known in the States. Then Amelia Simmons is like taking back a step or two steps in time. She was a self-declared orphan. She puts it on her title page. But very little else is known about her. It can only be deduced from this very simple little cookbook with, it was a real groundbreaker for American cooking. The first use of corn and kind of taking things on from there. It's a very simple book, the recipes, two or three lines, but perfectly coherent and easy to follow. You can create what she had in mind, like a really good, very early, a woman's household book from just the two or three lines that she describes. It's a perfect example of what was called a commonplace book, which I'm sure all of you have, which is a folder or a little booklet of all those recipes that you make quite often with the grandkids, and just don't want to forget, and you keep in the kitchen drawer. My mother, who hated cooking and was always in the garden, nonetheless left me a little commonplace book, and I've been doing some recipes out of my own things that I do with the grandchildren and all of that. And I think that women's cookbooks, you need to look at them with that in mind, that these are the household notes, particularly at the beginning, but even going on through once the books became printed and therefore were more widely available and could be more complex and with much more information. It was still very much books to not only to read, but to use in the kitchen, with the information that the person who wrote them felt was useful to her and therefore to her contemporaries. So Hannah Woolley has some cosmetics, and I think it's Hannah Glass that one of her recipes was a cure for the bite of a mad dog. It's more commonly how to cure a pneumonia on the chest and herbal remedies, those sort of things. And then gradually, the cookbook writers, a big change comes with, where am I? Well, Lydia Child, her recipes, she was a very different woman. She was, she was an intellectual. She ran her husband and the household. Her husband was kind of hopeless. She didn't have children. She just produced 40 recipes as part of a woman's encyclopedia. But that was the first book really compiled. The English version was much later by Mrs. Beaton. But Lydia Child established a model to be developed by other people.
Well, I think, just Lydia Child is a fascinating character because she was so politically active as well with so many other writings.
Exactly.
Staunch abolitionist working on beet sugar as an alternative to cane sugar that was produced on plantations. Truly, truly an amazing woman.
Absolutely. And I chose her to represent a very different style of person, personality and interest, much broader interests than focus, who nonetheless felt that every woman should have some recipes of her own. The next person, and I'm going to have to turn the light on in a minute in here, was a very different personality, Sarah Rutledge, daughter of a signer of the, I think I'm right, it's Declaration of Independence, Grand Dame of South Carolina. She established the kind of lexicon of Southern recipes. And she's the only one who, for whom we don't have a portrait. Thank you. A bit more light. But one can imagine her in those grand crinolined gowns. And she wrote the book, she said she was compiling it of recipes from her friends. And then we have a total change of pace. There's Fanny Farmer. Now that's the first real textbook. And one can see, I've never sort of empathized much with Fanny Farmer, but because she's sort of rather strict and rather full of rules. But looking at this portrait, she clearly also had a strong sense of humor. And she very much led the tradition of passing on cooking classes, of teaching not just the housewives, but their cooks. So she had classes for the young ladies of Boston who were getting married, and also for the young Irish girls off the boat who were going to be the first servants for these young women that she had taught. And then sort of running on, every American, surely everyone I'm talking to has a copy of Joy of Cooking.
Yes.
Brought Absolutely. Up the interesting point of the cookbooks that have been updated. So that I think Joy of Cooking is the first. And there have been revisions, constant revisions, of Joy of Cooking, bringing, there was one kind of new Joy of Cooking that was an embarrassing failure. So we won't dwell on that. But most of the ones, does everybody in chorus say, yes, I have a copy of Joy of Cooking on my shelf?
Yes, absolutely.
It's the first place one goes to look for the kind of original foundation recipe. Then running on through. Now, this is a total, of course, change of pace. Julia Child. The advent of cooking from other nations. So there's Julia, there's Marcella Hazan, and then two very much native daughters, Edna Lewis, Cooking of the South, Marcella in between, and then finally, to bring us up to speed on more or less the current scene, Alice Waters. And all of them, there are links one to another. And Alice, I think, is still leading all of us back into the countryside. Or if, praise be, you have your own garden, into the vegetable garden.
Well, so thank
you. So I try to link and suggest where we may be going. But just right now, goodness knows where we're going to be in a year's time. So I think any glimpse of the future is very misted.
Well,
use the clock, Fred. I insist on
it's lovely. I have a number of questions for you. That is such a wonderful overview of how cooking, particularly cooking in America, got to its current state. One of the first things, I tend to agree with you about Fanny Farmer. I've never really been able to warm up to her, in part because she does seem to be so strict about her level measurements. Yes, I understand they're very good, but there doesn't seem to be the joy in the kitchen of Fanny, for Fanny. And in particular, Fanny Farmer and Edna Lewis seem to take very opposite approaches to cooking. Edna is just intuitively brilliant and someone who contextualized recipes with little stories and made you understand much more about the recipe other than just a set of scientific formulas to follow to get a particular result. Would you consider them very much products of their time? Fanny coming of age at the beginning of the progressive era and really anticipating the progressive era, and Edna Lewis perhaps reacting against the industrialization of food? Or are there other things? Are there just personality differences? How would you assess them?
Very strong personality differences. And of course, their backgrounds were very different. A Bostonian, semi-intellectual household. And Fanny Farmer clearly adhered to the rules. I kind of like to think that the world of cooking and cooks divides in two halves. There are cuisine cooks and there are pastry cooks. And Fanny, though she wasn't an exclusively pastry chef, she was one of those people who like everything to be exact and precise, and you have to have cooking times and the shelf low down in the oven or in the middle and all the rest of it. And then there are people, and you can guess which one I belong to, who like to throw different things in and do a bit of experiment. And, well, wasn't really rather boring last time. Let's add a few herbs and spices or whatever. And speaking to, as we are, to quite a wide audience, I'm sure each of you belongs to one of those two camps, shall I say? Because you camp out in the other camp too, if you want to.
Yes, but there is a place where you are more comfortable naturally. I understand exactly what you're saying. And I have always been a little bit of a cowboy in the kitchen, just
Yes, well,
throw it around.
Take hands.
I do hate measuring things, which is why I am not a proficient pastry chef.
Look, thank goodness for the States, because you can use cups and tablespoons for everything, and you don't have to weigh it exactly in grams.
Yes, yes. So although, when absolutely forced, when it's really important, the scale does come out, but it's not something that I enjoy doing particularly. Now, when you were talking about herbs, that brings me to something else that you had in your book. And you and Julia are admitted Franco-gastrophiles, and I consider myself to be part of that group as well. No shame there. But we look at French cooking with, you know, at least haute cuisine with its mother sauces and variations and painstaking techniques. But you also complement the simplicity of Marcella Hazan's Italian cookery. Mm. Although you do have a quote from Julia, who perhaps wasn't quite as generous as you are, saying, and this is from your chapter on I think Marcella, quote, "I don't get the whole thing with Italian cooking. They put some herbs and things, they put them in the oven, and then they take them out again." And that's her assessment of Italian cooking. But do you think these two systems are really so different, that the French cookery from the Italian cookery? I think of some of the very complicated Italian dishes, you know, that timpano or a lasagna or a cima di vitello, that certainly to me have analogies in French cooking.
A structure.
A real structure and a requirement of careful technique in the assembly, and also something that takes some time. But I think that Julia was on to something when she expressed what seems to be a very common assumption, at least among Americans, that Italian cooking is simple and carefree and French is much more regimented. Do you have any thoughts on how that idea came about? What caused that dichotomy in looking at these two culinary systems?
Well, the Italians wrote the first cookbooks long, long before, of course, Marcella. So the Italians had originally a concept of a structure to cooking, but somewhere along the line, about the time of Catherine de' Medici, the baton, or the casserole, moved to France, and the French became much more intellectual and structured about it. So that in France, there's the acknowledged, structures of, anyway, regional cooking and classical cooking and historical cooking, and there was something in the 30s, and I can't remember what it was called. But like the French love to intellectualize everything, they did it with cooking, and that is a lot of what we learn with all the sources. And I think it can be compared to music, where the French would say, until you learn the scales, you can't play the music in the kitchen. Whereas the Italians would say, oh, you can improvise on the piano. You just need some ideas and a good touch on the keys.
Very interesting. There is a hand raised from Amelia. I am going to spotlight her, and if you can unmute yourself and ask your question, please.
Well, this was going back to Fanny Farmer, but of course now I've added a new part of the question with Italian versus French. I'm just going to ask if the possibility of Fanny Farmer, besides being persnickety, maybe was due to either wanting to guarantee success for women who now had to cook and didn't know how, and didn't have cooks any longer, but also to claim it. Was she trying to claim it as a science to give it a credibility in a man's world? That was my
question. That's an interesting point. She certainly felt that cooking should have rules and guidelines and should be carefully
corralled in the kitchen.
And the other thing, I really was curious about her, the broader context and of what was happening in her larger world. Sorry, there are a lot of dogs.
In her own larger world, what was happening was that large houses and great wealth were not so much disappearing, but she was writing for a new kind of middle class, possibly of intellectuals, but of educated women who were not enormously wealthy, who might or might not have a cook. And also for the young Irish girls or immigrants from other places who really didn't know anything about cooking in America. And it was at that stage that people were no longer, or the cooks were no longer relying on what they could find in the market that morning and grow in their garden, but that there were structured markets and shops where they could go out and know they could find a chicken or four different kinds of roots or whatever, so that a recipe could really be followed in detail.
Which isn't so different from what Julia decided to do about French.
Yes. Yes, exactly. There were certain ingredients that she really, that the French used and ways of using them that were crucial.
I think that's a very interesting question and segues into something I wanted to ask you about, which is that you draw distinctions between cookery books authored by men and women, saying that women's recipes tend to be simpler, warm-hearted, easier to execute, requiring less equipment, and calling for less expensive ingredients. And I think we certainly do see that in a lot of books, but this rule seems to bend, if not break, when we come to Julia Child. You knew Julia. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what Julia was really trying to accomplish, and particularly with the television program called The French Chef, obviously a gendered term there, or what we would think of as a gendered term.
Julia hated it.
It
was
the PR people that slapped it on the show when it was first launched. And Julia was never able to change it. She would say, "I'm a cook," she would say, "I'm not a chef." She really didn't like it. So is the simple answer.
Very interesting, because of course there was always that battle between Julia and Madeline Kamen.
Yes,
and Madeline, of course, was very dismissive of Julia's being called a chef.
Well, if they had managed to get along a little bit better, I'm sure Julia would have disabused her of the thought that it was she who had put Chef on. But there's an underlying story between the two of them that is a background to all of that.
Will you share that?
Well, it's a very, very old... but Julia was always extraordinarily generous about everybody. I never knew Julia. She would say, oh, well, that's something like a cooking could. She needs to learn a bit of this and that. But she would never be unkind about people. And she always felt they had cooked together at the very beginning there because they lived very close to each other. I think Madeleine lived in Cambridge too, but anyway, very close. And Julia felt that Madeleine had taken too many of her ideas.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. I had not heard that story.
No, well, Julia kept very quiet. But that was, she once or twice mentioned it. She always referred to her as the woman from Newton.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Never mentioned her name.
Yes. And I know, and Madeleine would complain that Julia never went to the restaurant that she ran.
She probably didn't, because by then there was the feud had developed.
Had gone, yes. That was a shame because they were two brilliant cooks.
Yes.
Utterly in their, both in their own way, absolutely brilliant. Michael Crondall has a question. Michael, I'm going to spotlight you. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hi there. And given the fact that you are kind of straddling this Anglo-American but also French divide, and that the role of women cooks is very significant in both the English and the, you know, in English, let's say, and in Germany too, as well, in Central Europe for that matter. But what would you say about women cookbook writers in France in comparison, first of all? And then I suspect your answer is going to be they are not as prominent. And I guess the second part of the question is why?
Well, why is a very interesting question. The first part of your comment, there are no cookbooks in French by women until the early 1900s, and Madame de Saint-Ange. And Madame de Saint-Ange had started a magazine called Le Cordon Bleu, and she compiled, they even have a copy here. Madame de Saint-Ange. There we are. Le Livre de Cuisine de Madame de Saint-Ange. Now this is possibly a first edition. I was very lucky. I married a man who loved books. And very shortly I was working at Gourmet magazine, and Mark said, if you want to write about cooking, you must have cookbooks. And he started collecting cookbooks for me to use. After 50 years, we had more than 2,000 cookbooks, including the really old ones. This isn't all that old, But anyway, this is Madame de Saint-Ange. And as you can see, she's one of those very Victorian-shaped, brick-like books. It's beautifully written. It's been rather poorly translated, but it is absolutely masterly and categoric on the composition of all the famous French recipes like coq au vin. I'm sure you know it. It has been reprinted, I'm sure, in the original French. And there is a rather poor translation. Sorry, the original question was, I guess, why are there so few? There are none. She is the first woman cookbook writer in French. And I explored that because it sounds very implausible. Surely there are now a lot of French women writing cookbooks. And there indeed were, going way back to the 20s. But it was the French men, I mean, Escoffier, but there were many cookbooks written by Frenchmen long before that. La Varenne, François Pigy wrote the first. I named La Varenne Cooking School for La Culinaire Française.
And there is a question that has appeared in the chat from Fiona Lucas, who asks if you are familiar with Stavely and Fitzgerald's United Tastes, a book that came out in 2017. It's a very nuanced study of Simmons' American cookery. They wonder if Simmons was a constructed persona rather than a real person by men championing an agrarian ideal in Connecticut. Fascinating, even if not an entirely convincing book.
I have not heard of it. I would be fascinated. And please, could you repeat the title?
It's United Tastes. Are Stavely and Fitzgerald.
Thank you.
And that's actually very interesting. I will have to go through my files, but there is a woman who has been investigating Miss Simmons, and she believes that she has found the evidence for Amelia Simmons and has more biographical data for her. I was not aware of this work either. So I will dig out her identity and make sure I can get it to you and send it to anyone who is interested. You can just post on our website if you would like the information, and we will make sure we can get it out there.
Got all my information from Karen Hess, who writes a good deal about Amelia Simmons, but I didn't know there was any further research. That would be very interesting, these two books.
Yes, I don't think it's been published formally, but that my information is several years old, so perhaps it has come out and I've missed it, but I will look for that and find it for everyone and post it, send it to you, Anne, and post it on our website. Are there additional questions from the audience? I've got one from Claire Stewart, which says, how do you view the future of cookbooks now that the internet is so often used to get recipes? And the cookbooks that are bestsellers are issued by the Food Network stars, and their popularity is so tied to their persona. Do you feel as sad about this as I do?
Well, that's two questions.
Now, could you just repeat?
Of course. How do you view the future of cookbooks now that the internet is so often used to get recipes? That's one question.
Well, I think the internet is so ephemeral that if you discover a good recipe on the internet, or if you discover a good recipe, you want to keep it and go back and use it again. So I think of its nature, you need to capture it and start making your own commonplace book in the kitchen. So there is a kind of discord between the internet and having recipes that you use and rely on and want to go back to. And then the second part of it
is the cookbooks that are bestsellers are issued by Food Network stars, and their popularity is tied to their persona. Do you feel as sad about this as I do?
Yes, but it depends on the persona. If it's a serious cookbook, I mean, Escoffier is a wonderful example. He was enormously famous, and he would go into the dining room and talk with the diners. I mean, in the sort of 70s and 80s of the with Ritz and at the Carlton. And when he wrote down his recipes, people really wanted to keep them. But of course, the chefs, his books, particularly La Culinaire, became completely the Bible for two generations. The chefs were still cooking from Escoffier. When I opened La Varenne in 1975, the chefs would still go to Escoffier to check the exact ingredients of a particular complicated sauce. So nothing replaced Escoffier for 70 years.
We have another question on the chat from James Mallon, who says that, of course, there were so many cooks who could not make it into your book, but considering your interest in French-American cuisine, did you consider Alice Toklas for the book?
No, I didn't. Because, I mean, there were many people. You asked me about Eliza Leslie.
Yeah.
That sort of had to be left out. And each of the cooks, the dozen cooks, kind of leads one from another. And I felt that we must have Edna Lewis.
Yes.
She was representative of, to some extent, a different time, but a different way of life. And of course, a different, simpler, more spontaneous kind of cooking. And from there, we had to have Julia. Goodness me. They would, their books, I think I'm right, were printed in the same year. But anyway, very, very close to each other. But they're worlds apart. And so Julia, of course, then had started the interest in European cooking or cooking of other nations. And I didn't want to get into Asian cooking because I don't know anything about it.
And Alice seemed to me the beginning of a new era that is already quite far advanced, but was getting, she took us all back to the land.
Yes. Yes, I think that is a very fair assessment and perhaps a nice place to put together or bring this part of the event to a close. I'm going to unmute everyone and let's give a hearty round of applause and thank you so much.
You're a great audience. Thank you.
And now I'm going to invite everyone. We are going to break into four different groups. It's going to be random. We'll hope this works well. And just have a pleasant chat as if you are enjoying one of our receptions. And we will move and between the different groups with a little bit of notice so you all know which is going to be whisked away through cyberspace so you can have a more intimate chat than we can with more than 40 people. It looks like we are in the high 30s now. So anyway, Anne, thank you so much. I think we can stop the recording and let's have a little socialization. Anyway, Christine, can you break us out?